You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farm's WGXC 90.7 FM Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest today is the amiable composer Dean Rosenthal, a resident of Martha's Vineyard, where in 2012 he composed his ongoing international performance piece titled Stones, Water, Time, Breath. This has become a popular piece, and in 2016, participants in 11 cities and 3 countries performed this work as part of the International Make Music Day Festival, inaugurating an annual event that is now in its 7th year. Rosenthal describes the work as experimental music in which participants choose any body of water and, using rocks found in situ or brought for the occasion, perform a set of actions designed to create a musical performance. It was born from an impromptu performance Rosenthal himself enacted that was later written down as a set of performance steps that can be performed by anyone. As he further explains, in performance, participants, with or without musical training, are invited to explore and inhabit listening spaces that include sound, silence, and the environment. In solo performances, these spaces are evident. In ensemble performances, community becomes a feature of the expressive activity. You can listen to this work on Rosenthal's website, but for those of you who are product lovers, it's also been released on CD by Edition Vondelweiser, documenting 5 live performances from Newfoundland to Brooklyn to New York to Wilbraham, Massachusetts, the composer's hometown. Kuhn and Rosenthal don't know each other very well, but Cage is a common link, as are many shared colleagues. This radio conversation serves as a kind of getting to know one another for the two. So welcome to All Things Cage, Dean. It's great to see you.
Yeah, it's good to be with you, Laura, technologically.
I was just saying to Dean, for our listening audience, that we have so many things in common, Dean and I, including a lot of friends, a lot of people over the years. And I'm just astonished that we didn't become best friends 20 years ago or 30 years ago, because our paths have been similar, even in terms of geography and things. We just share so much stuff.
You know, it's exciting to finally come back to meeting this way. I think the first time we had any kind of contact was probably around 2009, when I'm pretty sure I may have sent you something I wrote that came out of a lecture that John Cage had written, published in Silence, called Communication is Process. And this was kind of exciting. This was a lecture he gave at Darmstadt in September 1958. And he set it up as asking lots of questions in the third part of it. And I was living, I'm trying to think. Well, in any case, I had decided that it would be kind of fun to write answers to these. And I wasn't exactly sure it came out of what he was up to with Music of Changes and writing a response to a lecture. So I did that. And I put them up at some point. I wrote to Wesleyan University Press, said, oh, hey, can I use this? Can I do this? And they're like, yeah, sure, that's fine. So I ended up doing that. And I think I sent them to you and said, oh yeah, okay, these are interesting. And that was the first time that, Laura, that we had been in touch.
Uh-huh. I vaguely remember this. I probably put what you sent in the archives.
That would have been what I would imagine as well.
Exactly. I'll see if we have a decent audio communications process, because it would be maybe fun to share that with this audience.
Yeah, unbelievable. Such an innovative event at that time, I think in 1958, and just to be going over to Germany to kind of, I don't know, create this, I mean, what John Cage was up to then, a very pioneering experience in Europe at the time. Thinking about this, because I'm working on this book that I think I had told you about that has to do with experimental music in the United States, and always thinking of those new, never before done things that John Cage had brought to the United States and the world.
It's interesting about Darmstadt when you bring that up, because from where I sit about Darmstadt, I'm just amazed at how he could pull things off you know, that he would do something like his indeterminacy piece, you know, the stories that, which are so anecdotal and so genuine. And so, you know, they're just so sweet. And there he was in this gathering of, you know, the most technologically savvy, these really experimental guys who all sat around in suits, you know, and there he was talking about his Aunt Marge and the washing machine. And, you know, and I'm thinking he's about the only person that would have the, you know, the temerity to, you know, just do that absolutely straight. I just think they're just wonderful. Dean, tell me, because I honestly don't know. So when did you first encounter Cade?
So good question. It was at McGill University. I was probably in my third year in 1995. So that dates me as a Gen X, which I think is kind of exciting itself. But I came to just coming into contact with his ideas and his music pretty late, I think, compared to a good number of people out there. I was probably 20, and I think someone, this part is sort of the, you know, lots of people part, came across Silence. I think someone had turned me, you know, they just, oh, you know, you should have a look at this. And so I did. And that kind of, that was the start. And then I ended up just going from there.
Then did you reach out to him? Did you meet him?
Well, this was 1995. So
right.
I was about 20.
Oh, of course. Yeah. So you never met him?
No. I was 18 when he passed away, but I grown up in more of an isolated, just had no contact or hadn't even heard of experimental music or anything like that. So no, I have ended up knowing a lot of his, you know, the next generation.
Of course.
And, you know, people like you, and I mean, we were talking about Alan Rich earlier, who, you know, was close to Cage, and also Tom Johnson, who I know got to know him later in life, in particular, who I was.
I actually met Alan Rich not through Cage at all. I met through Nicholas Slonimsky, the Russian lexicographer who I worked with when I was in graduate school. Wow. And Alan and Nicholas were very devoted to each other. It was a threesome, actually. It was Nicholas Slonimsky, Alan Rich, and David Raxson, the composer, film composer, who, among many other things, wrote the song Laura, or the film Laura, for which I was named.
Yeah, wow. So this was in Los Angeles, right?
I grew up in California. I grew up in Northern California, but I went to graduate school at UCLA.
Right.
Which is where my parents were from. And my grandparents were there when I was in graduate school.
It's a great place to be, Los Angeles. So,
yeah.
Of course, yeah, you know, I mean, John Cage, the history that he had there, whether it was in Santa Monica, I don't know, other people think, going to high school, all the different things there. So
I loved LA. Yeah. I was one of the few San Franciscans who didn't say disparaging things about Los Angeles.
Those are two very, very different cities. So definitely I admire that the conflict was resolved.
Yes, it was never a conflict for me. I just enjoyed the two environments, if you will, you know, that I moved freely because I was a native Californian, and because my parents were from Los Angeles, I felt like a native Angeleno as well as a San Franciscan, right. You know what I mean? So I never felt like I had to choose. It was just two parts of the state. And Alan Rich had, so going back to Nicholas and Alan Rich and David Raxson, it was really adorable because there was 20 years between them. And 1 year, Alan was going to have his, I think it was his 65th birthday. It might've been his 60th. I'd have to look it up. But Betty Freeman, who was super close with Alan because of the musicals that they gave together, Betty was going to Turin with her husband, Franco, and she gave me $50 and asked me to throw a little dinner party for Alan in her absence. So it was Nicholas and Alan and the birthday boy and David Raxson, me, my boyfriend at the time, a couple of other people, but that was it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
well, that, you know, I'll tell you, Alan Rich, who wonderful late critic of the LA Weekly, but which is how I first met him at a concert at, I think it was a very new Frank Gehry Los Angeles Philharmonic spot. I was in Los Angeles for a year at Cal Arts, which I left, and is also kind of an interesting story. But in any case, this was Giorgi Ligeti. They were celebrating something or other, and Paul Griffiths, the musicologist, historian, he was giving a talk about the six pieces for wind quintet, and it walked in. You know, there really weren't too many people there because you would have had to have driven in just for some kind of short lecture. Sat down, Alan Rich walks in, trying to think. I had to get up to use the men's room, and we met, I think, after, when he sat back down and he just said, oh, I just came from UCLA where they did, I don't know, it was something that Philip Glass had put together that was premiering there, which had been interesting. So, oh, well, that won't be repeated, or something like that. And then, oh. Yeah, right. I don't know. He wasn't a fan of that particular piece. And I don't know, we got to talking and he just decided that, you know, we should catch up. And so I think from there, we ended up, anyway, that's how we first met, but we ended up doing a lot in Los Angeles together. And I ended up getting to hear about his experiences with Betty Freeman, with John Cage, going to many of the events in Los Angeles. I think we went ourselves to see the Sun Ra Orchestra. He made dinner. He was really just a charming, warm, friendly man. And I have very positive memories of that time with him. And yeah, I also seem to recall just talking with him on the phone for, I don't know, just great guy. It was.
Yeah,
just,
yeah, yeah. No, I agree. He was lovely. Yeah. All of my friends in Los Angeles, when I moved to New York, because I was, as I said, a native Californian. So the idea that I was moving to New York was unthinkable. Wow. To all the people around me, because they said, oh, you're going to hate it. And there's no beach and there's no this and there's no that. And they gave me this party. It was a surprise party. This was in West LA. Right. And Alan was there, and Alan gave me as a gift a pair of high-end noise reduction headphones. And nice. That was for me to wear as I was moving around New York, because the city was unbearably loud. And I was obviously used to, you know, California sunshine and birds chirping and, you know, waves lapping.
Now, he had come to Los Angeles from New York, if I remember
correctly. I honestly don't know where he was from.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
he would Google that easily.
Esteemed critic for a very long time. I feel very thankful that I had the opportunity to run into him.
And yeah, he was also very loyal. He was a loyal person. He was attentive to his friends. Nicholas, for example, because Nicholas was so much older than everybody else. When I gave that party on Betty's behalf for these three men, it must have been that Nicholas would have been 100. David Raxon would have been 80 and Alan was turning 60. And Nicholas was turning 100, looked 80. You know, David Raxon was 80, looked 60. And Alan was turning 60 and looked 40. They were all just, you know, genetic marvels. Do you know Charles Amerikanian?
Yeah, not too well, really, at all. But I mean, he's in San Francisco. And because of the book, I wrote to him about something that had to do with Conlon Nankow.
Nice. So, nice. Yeah, I brought him up because when he found out, he and I were really good friends in the Bay Area where I grew up. And he was in El Cerrito. He was living, I think he's still in Carroll, are still living in El Cerrito. But he pulled me aside and he said, you're going to UCLA. You're going to UCLA. And I said, yeah, for grad school. And he said, you have to get in touch with Nicholas Leninsky and you have to go help him. Just help him. Whatever he needs, you just do it.
Yeah. No, it's, I mean, he's such an extraordinary figure when you think going back to the 1930s, conducting three places in New England or
touring at the Hollywood Bowl, for God's sake.
unbelievable contribution that Nicholas Slamsky made, as well as that curious thesaurus of I can actually
scales.
Yeah, very unique figure. And I remember he went on Johnny Carson too at one point, started playing his music, conducting with
I was backstage. You know,
yeah, so unbelievable. Were you?
Yeah, yeah. I still have a tape of it if you want me to make you a dub.
Yeah, no, that would be amazing. I would
yeah, because the television station gave us, it was back in the days of VHS tapes, you know.
Yeah, sure. I remember those. I do recall
them. Yeah, yeah, yeah. David Raxon was, David Raxon was funny. He was a funny guy. He liked to make jokes all the time, really bad. They were bad jokes. And whenever we were celebrating anything or having a party, David Raxon would write a song to the tune of whatever, celebrating the present moment, whatever it was.
Well, that sounds lovely. That sounds true.
Yeah.
You know, it occurred to me earlier today, I was thinking John Cage and Vivian Perlis, just to, you know, sort of thinking about all things Cage again, that were they, Vivian Perlis, of course, you know, the oral historian.
Of course. No, we were close.
Oh, no, I know. If any, you know, the listening just is not familiar with Vivian Perlis, the director and founder of Oral History of American Music, just a collection of oral history interviews at Yale. She died on the 4th of July a couple of years ago. And she and John Cage were very close. And through working with the oral history in a couple different ways, I've gotten to know a little bit about their times together. And I wonder if you encountered her or if you spent time with her and John together or anything like that.
Sure. That was something I asked. Sure. I mean, a couple of times we would have dinner together at John's house. I would cook or John would cook. Actually, John mostly cooked because he was so good. But I actually met Vivian when I was in college, not grad school, but when I was in college in Northern California. Mm. I was a concert reviewer for the local Gannett publication. Mm-hmm. And we all belonged to the Music Critics Association of North America. And the first time I ever met Vivian was in Santa Fe, New Mexico at a MCA conference. I thought she was truly one of the most beautiful people I had ever seen. She was tan from the New Mexico sun. She was wearing bright, bold colors, like desert kind of colors. Mm-hmm. She was really, really striking. And she was smart as a whip. And she was playful and funny. She was lovely. And Cage liked her very much.
Glad to hear that. You know, I wouldn't have come across Vivian Perlis in my life, except for that I ended up being asked to write a piece that was a portrait of hers, sort of a sonic portrait for the 50th anniversary of the collection that she put together of oral histories. I just found through her work, whether it was with John Cage or Charles Ives or really any of, you know,
Aaron Copland.
Well, Aaron Copland, of course. And just such a remarkable figure in American music history that, you know, in the connection there through the music that she had put together, I don't know, there was a PBS Master series that she did.
Right. It was called I Have Nothing to Say and I'm Saying It. It was for David Alan Miller, who was the filmmaker.
Right. Well, it was something that I had wanted to, you know, just find out to see where that, you know, if you had. And, you know, it's a good thing to know.
We have if you're ever looking for a research project and you want to come over, hang with us for a while and help. David Alan Miller gave us all the outtakes from that film and the following film that he did on Cage. So we have boxes of stuff that end up getting used.
But she, they just seem like they had such a nice exchange. And in the interviews that she did that I made the piece out of, there was only one of her, which is just on the OHAM site in the New York Public Library, the Performing Arts Library, just put it into a special collections of some kind that people can go and listen to if they're in New York with the notes. There was just these exchanges that she had with him and her voice, and they played this piece together that I guess Cage had done. I don't know, there was something called Off the Wall that was at Symphony Space in New York.
It was a kind of a music circuit. So it was a big
right. And this was a big deal. And so, you know, John Cage had that going on and they were close. And so there was this piece, I think it was the radio piece, 1956.
Yeah, that's in the film. That made it a cut.
That's right. And so they had a conversation about this, and it was just so interesting what she recalled, because she was a harpist, but I don't think she had really played too much experimental music, contemporary music, even though she was such close friends with someone like John Cage. And so he had made a comment to her during that. She said, well, what if I miss? You know, there are all these timings on the score and you have to turn the radio on at a different time or change the dial or reach, you know, a particular frequency at a particular time. And well, you know, I mean, what if I miss it? What should I do? And I guess what he had said was something like, well, you know, no one will probably know, maybe I will know, but don't miss. And it struck me as something that just seems so warm and, I don't know, very true about, you know, someone I wish I had met for sure. So that just seems like some nice thing to say.
There was another piece that she was involved in, Dean. It was called, I can only remember half of it. There were two pieces. One, the half that I remember the title of is Cassette. Remember this at all? I think Vivian put it together with H. Wiley Hitchcock
from
Brooklyn.
Yeah, sure.
And it was a piece where Cage solicited from his friends anything that they were willing to provide to him to use on cassette tape. Wow. So it could be an interview with them. It could be anything. It could be a lecture.
Okay, yeah, go on.
Yeah. Anyway, I have to look this up. And it's well documented in the Institute for Studies in American Music monograph, number 14, which was titled The Phonograph and Our Musical Life. And this was itself the proceedings of a centennial conference that took place in 1977 at Brooklyn College. And I just found the citation for it. And Cassette was a new piece that Cage had conceived as the keynote address for this conference, in which five panelists played various lectures on cassettes that were provided to them by Cage. This was very much the brainchild of H. Wiley Hitchcock and Vivian Perlis.
I don't know. I was saying, I mean, it just seems like such a wonderful thing to say about indeterminate music. Something, you know, just sort of joyful. Well, nobody will probably know, you know, maybe I'll know, but don't miss, you know,
right,
don't make
a
mistake. I don't know. That just seems like a real lesson from the past to the present. And so I don't know. It's just, that's such a warm thing to say.
No, I think, you know, I went to a lot of concerts with John, and the truth is that what moved him the most, it was clear, was the dedication to the process by the performer, you know? So somebody who really, it mattered to them to do it well, whatever they were doing well. They may not have been the best singer in the world, but they were so intent upon bringing everything they had to what they were doing. And that,
yeah.
Cage just loved that.
All about it. Yeah, that sounds great.
So that answer to Vivian is exactly right. You know, just don't miss. Don't miss. Did you know the composer? She was more a teacher. She was a teacher of mine actually at UCLA, who then named Pia Gilbert.
The name is kind of stirring.
Yeah. So well, she and Vivian were best friends.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. So, and Vivian passed away, right?
Yeah, 2 years ago.
Like 2 years,
Yeah, that was a light one out, in my opinion. I don't know, I've been very, involved in some respects in her legacy through this piece and through the book that is related to owe him to the Oral History of American Music. And
we also have stuff from her, from the Oral History. No, and Vivian gave us boxes of stuff.
So, yeah, and it's amazing to me how she was, for example, so close to Aaron Copland and also John Cage, who you would think, well, you know, these are two completely different American composers. So that's interesting in itself.
Yeah, she was close to Carter, too, wasn't she? Elliot Carter. She didn't write about him, but I think she was friends, very close with him. That's another, you know, another kind of dark horse in that closet, you know.
Right, right.
Dean, so I was interested to learn by looking at all of your stuff, your website, of course, but just really reading about you, that you're one of the few people I can say that I know now that is a composer, but you don't do something else. You don't make pizza at night. You don't teach. You don't, you know what I mean?
I have been known to do other things, but I mean, where's the, what should we talk about with respect to that? So...
you don't have to say anything. It was just you're a very productive composer. You know, when
I'm not sure I see that. I write like a piece every year or 2 years or something. But
you're pretty regular with it.
Okay. Well, I don't know. I had a thing for a little while where, you know, if something came up, I would do it. And if not, it would kind of, I don't know, do I feel just so inspired to write something right now? And that never more recently hadn't made much sense to me because of the way things were had sort of unfolded in the last 10 years. I had really only been composing, I would say, since 2009. Even though I'm 47 now, I had a lot of mental health struggles and psychiatric hospitalizations, things that just took away from my 30s and late 20s. And so when I came back to composing, I think it more had to do with something I just really wanted to focus on. And I don't know, you know, my wife and I have been able to make it work out of, you know, where you have a life where you can do that. So that's been really healthy and happy. But I do other things. I have held and I don't know, just had strange, curious, you know, things that have occurred along.
Fair enough. It was just fun to see a bio that was like, in the main, it was all these different kinds of compositions and all these different places you've performed. So from the outside, looks pretty productive.
Oh, that's interesting. No, and all, I'm glad it appears that way. I feel pretty, I definitely feel like I've gotten somewhere, but I think the life of being a composer, Tom Johnson, the American minimalist and the writer for The Village Voice, and, you know, he's in Paris now. I met him. He was one of the first, you know, after I started to get healthy again in 2008 or 2009, I came across his website. I said, wow, this guy's writing all this mathematical music. This is incredible. You know, this really speaks to me. I'm going to, you know, and he was somebody, you know, if you're trying to, like, I don't know, reach out to, it depends on who you're looking to reach out to, but I wrote to him and he wrote right back and said, oh yeah, you know, this is kind of interesting what you're up to. And one of the first things he said to me in an earlier email, he said, well, you know, the interesting thing about being an artist or a composer is, you know, you may stick with it and you may not and see how, you know, what you're up to, but it's unpredictable. It's an unpredictable life, but it can have very positive consequences. And I feel like by being open to different things that have just sort of appeared or come my way, and other things that have not made sense that I've decided not to choose, that you kind of move along that way. So, yeah, it's interesting. It's the first time that somebody has asked me that question, but I don't know. So yeah,
you are now living in Martha's Vineyard.
I live on Martha's Vineyard. It's
which
true.
Is kind of a, you know, it's kind of heaven on earth.
It is a bit of a Shangri-La, but there's you know, a story behind that, a pretty quick one, which is just that I had been coming here on and off with my parents who also live here. And eventually, I don't know, my wife and I were living in Western Massachusetts after period in New York together. And we had made plans to move overseas. Berlin was very hot. This was around 2011, 2012. And I had gotten German dual citizenship that had to do with World War II and things like that. And at the last minute, you know, I took a weekend to come down. It's the other end of Massachusetts. And I just thought, okay, we're always looking for some place to maybe live there and just see something. And I found this rental that was $899, which later we found out had to do with some kind of a tax break, why that one extra dollar up to 900 wasn't there. So we did that, but living here can be actually, the year-round community is very different than the international image of the playground of the rich and famous, which it becomes in the summer sometimes.
Like Aspen, that's like Aspen, the same.
Key West is another one. Yeah, all of those things. Like, so yes, but living here, we own a home that we were able to buy from the town for a much reduced price. And it's a great place to be. It's further away. And, you know, I think experimentalists sometimes, I don't know, just reading earlier today, it was like, whether it was Lou Harrison or Harry Partch or John Cage up in Sunny Point, like you can go these places that are more, they're calmer and quieter maybe, and you have more space to just stretch out upstairs. And I don't know, I think that's great.
Yeah, no, I think that's probably true. Whenever I think about Harry Partch, I think about Barstow. Because he wrote the Hitchhiker songs, you know, they're all set in this place called Barstow, California, which there was nothing in Barstow, nothing. Mm. It might have been a bus stop.
Wow.
Yeah, it was like really there was nothing there, Dean. It was just amazing. And it got to 120 degrees in the summer. But he loved Barstow. He loved that, you know, that whole environment. But I brought that up for a reason. I brought up that you're living in a vineyard because I take it that your long piece, The Stones, it's called Stones, Water, Time, Breath. For our listening audience, you composed that in 2012. That was an inspiration of Martha's Vineyard, I would assume.
Yes, no. The piece is a piece where, you know, to kind of sum it up, you go out to the water and maybe some stones are already there, or maybe you bring them with you. And you play music with the stones rhythmically at the water. And it's ecological, it can be community oriented, but it's about sound and it's music. It's not a free for all. And the connection to Martha's Vineyard is, yes, that it was written here. And there is that, I don't know, it feels like a personal connection to it. But I do think it could have been written somewhere else, actually, Laura.
Right. I guess I was being really way more literal than you're taking my question, you know, that I think of Martha's Vineyard as being really influenced by water, really by, you know, that you have the geography of this piece around you all the time. So I don't think this piece wouldn't come out of Newark, New Jersey.
Yeah. You don't see it composed at the East River or something like that.
No. Maybe. But, you know, there's something romantic about Martha's Vineyard.
Time you're here, I will show you where it was written, which, you know, has its own bit of history for me. And yeah, it's been a more successful piece for me. And, I do love that piece. I think you know, the idea that I wanted to make it also over the years so that really anyone could try it out. And that in experimental music, sometimes you find this sort of what I call like rarefication, you know, like where only a specialist can play something very straight ahead, straightforward in terms of its text instructions or visual interpretation. And here I thought, well, you know, what it's like, anybody can do this. And as long as they're paying attention to it, like you were saying earlier, you know, that the performers, maybe they weren't the best singers, but they were so close to what the process was. And that, I mean, I really use a John Cage story, even sometimes when, if someone asks about how to perform it, someone who's familiar with experimental music, I'll talk about Atlas Eclipticalis. And this is this orchestra piece that, as you know, when the New York Philharmonic went to play it, and it was, you know, they were mic'd up. And I think this was, do you remember when that piece was premiered by that?
Like 64 or something like that.
It was 1964, and this was very progressive notation, you know, and it became something like a free-for-all. And he was not
for that. They broke their microphones. They ripped them off of their stands and trampled on them.
Did he ever talk to you about that?
Yes, he was furious, but it was a long time before I came along. You know, I wasn't in his life until the mid 80s. So all of that was long gone, you know, but he was mad. You know, they destroyed, he bought those microphones. He bought them and provided them. And so that he felt personally, you know, offended that they had destroyed his property.
He was even more upset from an aesthetic point of view, but maybe not. You know, with other experimental musicians who are aware of it, of that incident, and it's a pretty famous incident, that a piece like Stone's Water, Time Breath, or other pieces like it, like it's, these aren't free-for-alls, you know, they have sort of instructions, which are a score, even if they're just words, and it's important to look to that and to pay attention to it. And
yeah, of course, yeah. You know, but you also, let's go back to another person that you referenced, Dean, because one of the great entrees for me into Tom Johnson was that beautiful little collection that I think it's called 88 Pieces or what is that?
Okay.
Is that Music Brain.
Music Brain.
Yeah. And it is that very thing that you're talking about, you know, go and get this and do this with it. You know, and anybody could do it. All it took was a kind of dedication to trying something new and being open-minded about the result.
I
can't remember the name of it.
Yeah, that one that you're thinking of, I think it's called Private Pieces. It was like a collection of text scores that maybe it was. But, you know, the idea of that openness, that this piece also, you know, it's sort of, I mean, I guess obviously accepting, you know, the results of it in sort of this chance-oriented way, but also being aware of yourself within the process or aware of the music while you're listening to it, while you're performing it, and that you're in this ecological, this outdoor space. So there have been a lot of interpretations of it. There was a recording that came out. It's been on Edition Volalizer Records, named Stone's Water, Time Breath, and it's been performed in, I don't know, in South America and Europe and in Canada and all this, you know, in China, and it was, you know, it's been translated, and a lot of people really, you know, linked up with this, and that's been a nice thing. And
well, I think it has a great deal to do with the fact that it's a participatory piece, you know, that you're, by taking it on, you are joining this body of people who are interested in this kind of work. You know what I mean? It's not virtuosic in the normal sense of virtuosic. It is, in fact, virtuosic, but it's not in the normal sense, you know, that anybody could do it.
Well, and that was part of the thing that I become happier to open that up, Laura. And I feel like it's interesting that you mentioned that, because sometimes it'll come out. Martha's Vineyard, I found, there's not an experimental music community here, of course. And my wife and I play a duo together, and we present a concert maybe once or twice a year. But the community is very open and very interested in different kinds of music. It doesn't have that kind of judgmental quality to it. I don't know, maybe that you find somewhere, or I don't really know, but it seems, you know, different things are controversial in different places. And so here, when I, you know, someone might hear the piece, or I might come into contact with somebody through some experience, like more recently making, you know, copies of some kind of something like that. And we start talking, they come up with it, and they don't have anything to do with experimental music, but they can go out to the water and form this piece. And, you know, they get interested in it. They're creative. They can read the instructions. I always tell them, you know, you pay attention to it, but it's not something that you need to be an experimental musician, have conservatory training or anything like that.
Of course. Necessarily know, would you, that it was a work which was outside of the tradition. You know what I mean? If you were not in that tradition.
I like to think, maybe
I'm wrong, Dean, but I like to think that there are places in the world that are more receptive to that kind of a piece, like Martha's Vineyard, like Centralia, Washington, like Los Angeles, like, you know, places that have a connection with nature, kind of forced upon them in a way, because of the geography of where you are, the location.
I don't know. I find it seems to be in Los Angeles, there's a group of people that perform it every year. I think there's Reservoir Echo Park. Is that right?
Yeah, something. Sure.
So they went there to do that, and they go every year. But they do have a connection to the experimental music community there. So to relate to what you said, yeah, I think maybe I don't know. You know, I don't have an answer for that. But I think it draws in a lot of different kinds of people who want to try out something new, who are not musicians, who are still open in the creative arts, or maybe even just intrigued by something different, who will give it a shot. And some of the best performances come out of that, really.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. I think that, you know, let's go to Cage for a second on this topic. I'm going to play something of his, I think, at the end of this program that's going to tie nicely into this conversation. But I think that for Cage, one of the things that he enjoyed about his so-called nature pieces, these works of contingency, where he used plant materials or water, or I think that one of the primary things that he enjoyed about that was the ephemerality of the instruments, that, you know, you can't master a piece of cactus. You can't become masterful over it. It will, in fact, the more you use it, it will disintegrate. It won't, you know, it's not going to hold up. So you can't approach it that way.
Yeah, and he was miking cactuses and cacti.
Exactly, you know, exactly.
Making pieces out of them. I complete agreement, you know.
I think it's not a mystery in the sense that he was from Los Angeles. You know, you were from Western Massachusetts. And Merce Cunningham, who, by the way, died in 2009. So you kind of emerged from your cocoon back into the world right around the time Merce Cunningham died. But he loved this piece by Cage called Inlets. He even made a dance, and it always, the dance mimicked the movement of seabirds on sand as the tide came in and out, or tide pools, or things that maybe didn't even move except for the being pushed by water, like rocks, you know, little stones or anyway, there's a temperament.
The idea of nature, imitating nature
in her manner of operation.
So great. I don't know, so much of that closeness to nature and that openness, I think, you know, of course, that's such a big influence on younger composers, you know, when they're younger, I guess, or older, really anybody. And so I know for me personally, having come into contact with that kind of openness to composing and openness to nature, of course, those end up being influential in your own point of view when you're a composer oriented person, of course.
Yes, sure. When is your book going to come out? I'm really
right. So
I'm so curious about it.
It is it's an oral history of experimental music. It's the first of its kind, and it will come out probably not until 2026. I thought about this earlier today.
Wow, really? You're going to work on this for 4 more years?
No. Well, I'll tell you, it's with Oxford University Press, which is to me exciting and interesting. And I will note that John Cage, for all of his openness in that regard, his books were published with Wesleyan. They were published with the university press, at least Silence and some of the other ones. And So this wasn't a book that I proposed, but was asked to write. And when I was asked to write it, I thought, okay, this is going to be an extraordinary amount of work. But like we talked about earlier, it should be something that I should be open to, because this seems right to do. When we went through with Oxford to try to assess, you know, how is this going to work? We realized, okay, you know, I'm not a musicologist, I'm not a scholar, but I've written a fair amount and I know how to write. But this will take a while. I want to put this together. So they gave me a lot of time to finish it, because manuscripts have deadlines with presses. And so that's through 2024, through mid 2024. And then people read it and copy edit it and that kind of thing. It takes more time. So maybe 2025. I guess, but I'll be writing it until 2020.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to it.
I do too.
Anytime an author says to me, as you did, not to me personally, but you wrote, it's an impossible book to do. I love that. So it's like, yeah, you're right. It's impossible. Now go do it.
For the 20th century, Laura, it's for the 20th century, which is this huge span of time. It ends before our time, before this time, which we're almost a quarter way through the 21st century. And, you know, it was such a diverse period, diverse history over this span of time. But to try to create something that is, you know, it just, that's impossible. So when everyone reads the introduction, which they will, they'll see me scrambling to try to explain that, you know, this book couldn't have been written, but here I am attempting to do something for you, the reader. So
right. Well, I look forward to it. We're going to have to stop, believe it or not, because we need to leave some time for me to talk a little bit about you behind your back.
Oh no.
And to play some music, which I have to kind of dig around and see what might be so the best
exciting
thing.
Yeah, let's listen to Inlets. That sounds great. And Laura, I can't tell you how much, just how exciting it is to speak with you and to do this. When you're a lot younger and you're an undergraduate, you're a student, you're in a library somewhere, wherever you are, and you come across this kind of, you know, oh, it's John Cage, what is this book? What's going on? And then, you know, 25 years later, you find yourself speaking with the trust itself, or just, I don't know. It's always kind of like, well, you know, this is really, it's something new. And it's just, you know, it's just a pleasure. I don't know.
I'm just so pleased that you were so quickly agreeable to doing it.
Well,
you were fearless. You were fearless. Not really? Everybody's fearless. A lot of people say, well, I'll have to study for a while. I'll get back to you. You know.
No, you just like
they. It's a conversation, fool. It's not a test.
Yeah, you have to say yes to what fits. And this was very clearly something immediately that I was like, yeah, no, this makes. Laura and I definitely have some catching up to do. So let's, you know, I'm all in.
It's been a pleasure, Dean. I'll holler at you once the program's done, but it won't air for a couple of weeks yet. It's really been a pleasure to get to know you. I have not had a sense of you, and you've really been kind of in my life for a long time. Mm. So thanks.
You know, the next time I'm up in the Hudson Valley, I will make sure.
Come visit.
So I do show up there from time to time.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Dean. Take care of yourself.
Take care.
Okay. Bye. Now let's listen to a bit of a beautiful recording of John Cage's Inlets from 1977, which, like Dean Rosenthal's ongoing international performance piece, Stone's Water, Time, Breath from 2012, uses water as an essential sound source. Cage's Inlets is scored for a finite performance by three players of water-filled conch shells, and one conch player using circular breathing and activating the sound of fire. This work was originally used as music for the eponymous choreographed piece by Merce Cunningham, with lighting by Charles Atlas and stage decor and costume design by the Seattle artist Morris Graves, often referred to as a mystical painter of nature.
Cunningham, a native son of Centralia, Washington, was particularly fond of Cage's work, and he used it again in 1983 for a work he entitled Inlets 2, with stage design by Mark Lancaster. The players are instructed to cradle and rock amplified conch shells of varying sizes that have been partially filled with water in order to produce gurgling sounds, which, by the way, may or may not happen. The work also calls for the sound of burning pine cones, live or pre-recorded, and a single tone produced on a conch shell, which is used as a trumpet. This work exemplifies Cage's interest in contingency. In his definition, meaning improvisation, using elements in which there is discontinuity between cause and effect. The work was premiered in Seattle at the University of Washington on September 10, 1977, the year it was composed, and its length is indeterminate, usually taking the same length as whatever is happening on the stage. The performers in this recorded performance were John Cage himself, along with Peter Mercier, Mel Mercier, and John David Philemon, father and son Merciers, and Philemon being key collaborators on another of Cage's works featured earlier on All Things Cage, his much-beloved Roratorio, An Irish Circus on Finnegan's Wake. And as to Dean's assurances that such works are not a free-for-all, I've performed this work many times myself, and I can assure you there is a score. Thank you.
preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.